and at the age of 31 was posted to Uganda, where he is said to have calmed the superstitious natives by killing two man-eating lions. He re-enlisted in the army to fight in the Second Boer War, in which the British, in pursuit of newly discovered gold deposits, fought Dutch or Boer settlers for territory using scorched earth policies and setting up concentration camps for Dutch settler women and children. In 1913, Patterson joined the Ulster Volunteer Force, an illegal militia set up by Protestant settlers in the north of Ireland to resist decolonization by force of arms. Viciously anti-Irish, they formed from a milieu which subject Belfast to a reign of terror. Night after night, the streets are paraded by orange mobs looking for victims. In the 1914 to 1918 war, Patterson, a convinced Christian Zionist, founded and commanded the Zion Mule Corps, an all-Jewish unit which was involved in the fighting at Gallipoli. The unit was then disbanded, but later in 1917, in collaboration with the extremist revisionist Zionist Vladimir Jabotinsky, a so-called Jewish Legion was formed. It fought the Muslim army of the Ottomans in Jerusalem. This paved the way for the British Mandate and the horrors of the later Zionist military occupation in 1948. One of the soldiers under Patterson's command was David Green, who later became the first Prime Minister of the Zionist entity under the name David Ben-Gurion. Patterson died in 1947, but in 2014, his remains were reinterred in a grave in Netanya beside some dead members of the Jewish Legion. The Minister of Defense and the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, gave an oration. Patterson was described by Netanyahu as the godfather of the Israeli army. Patterson personally knew Netanyahu's father, Benzion, and was appointed godfather for Netanyahu's brother, Jonathan, who had been named after Patterson.
And as such, he can be called the godfather of the Israeli army. He also happened to be the godfather of my late brother, Jonathan, who was named after him, and a personal debt.
Ulster loyalism and Zionism are ideological twins, and John Henry Patterson was a symptom of the close relationship between differing settler colonial projects, united in their racist contempt for the natives and support for ethnic cleansing.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our other expert guest today is Professor Bill Ralston. Bill is an emeritus professor of sociology at the University of Ulster. He's written widely on the conflicts in Ireland, including documenting the experience of relatives of those killed by state forces, and has charted the involvement of death squads in the violence. He's also, without doubt, the world's leading authority on political murals in the north of Ireland. And Bill joins us today from Belfast. Welcome to the show. Bill, I want to ask you about your research on murals. Can you tell us a little bit about how they relate to the politics of Irish Republicans and indeed how they relate to the politics of loyalists too?
Well, Chris, I've done a number of books on the murals and I've titled each of them Drawing Support. And it's a play on words, but the notion is that each set of murals attempts to mobilize popular support for the cause that has been represented in the mural. On the Republican side, that has been that began with the hunger strike in 1981, but developed into support for all sorts of other Republican positions, local positions, and indeed positions about international solidarity. On the Loyalist side, the murals are older, and they centered around the Orange Marches on the 12th of July, the annual celebration of King William, Protestant King William's victory at the Battle of the Boyne in 1690. Later, they became a way of mobilizing support for loyalist paramilitary groups and had a much narrower range of issues and a much narrower range of focus than the Republican murals.
I mean, David, I know that you've been to Belfast recently and you saw this mural close. I mean, what did you make of it?
Well, I've been to Ireland a lot. I did my PhD in the north of Ireland, travelled quite a lot across the province, as it's called by the loyalists. and then to Derry and Belfast and Armagh and Fermanagh and all those kinds of places. And so I'm familiar with the fact that Israeli flags fly quite regularly in loyalist areas of Belfast. But I was quite surprised to see this mural, such a detailed historical account of the origins of this guy, Patterson, who had been an Irish Protestant settler, who'd fought, you know, against decolonization with the UVF, an illegal militia, and then had gone on to found the Israeli army, a story I was not familiar with at all, and which I thought was fascinating. And to see that this is up there represented on the streets, just near the peace line in West Belfast on the loyalist side, I thought was an extraordinary parallel with the accounts that you see of what's happening in Palestine. So there's a really strong sense in this this mural of the affinity between the loyalist position and the Zionist position. And that, I think, is correct. They see it, and we see it too. It's correct that they are supportive of Zionism, and it's correct that the Republicans are supportive of the Palestinians. And these are natural positions. These are not tribal loyalties or somehow cherry-picked ways of showing that they support another struggle. These are profound relationships which parallel each other in both the north of Ireland and indeed in Palestine.
I mean, Bill, is it true that the political themes in loyalist murals tend towards a militaristic, and is this mural an exception?
To the first bit of that question, absolutely true. Since the late 1980s, that has been the overwhelming focus of loyalist murals. They are controlled by the paramilitary commanders, and in effect, the paramilitary commanders paint advertisements for their organizations. That has changed a little bit recently. This one is, yes, clearly a militaristic mural. Anything that's about a lieutenant colonel who was involved in setting up the Jewish army, as it was originally called, is clearly militaristic. But it begs the question of how that mural is read by other people. Now, I would suggest that people passing by it, loyalist people passing by it, would have a range of relationships to that mural. Some would see it as too cluttered to even bother trying to figure out what it's trying to tell them. At the other extreme, some would see it as a wonderful endorsement of their ideological position. I'm not going to do it here, but we may want to explore exactly what that ideological position is, whether it is specifically about Zionism or whether something more complicated is going on.
David, this guy, John Henry Patterson, he fought with the revisionist Jabotinsky, who famously, as you know, made a deal with the Ukrainian nationalists involved in pogroms against the Jews. I mean, was Patterson ideologically Zionist, do you know?
It does seem so. He seems to have been quite committed Christian Zionist. And again, this is something which people really don't know about, the kind of the history of Christian Zionism. It's not just something dreamt up in the US in the 1980s or 70s. It has a long history going back to particular understandings of Christian theology, and in this case, to do with particular understandings of the role of the settler and the native. So he saw a strong parallel between his role as a settler in Ireland and the role of the Zionists wanting to become settlers in Palestine. And of course, he helped to set up the militia which made that a fact in 1948. So very, very, very interesting that he was a very convinced Christian Zionist from the very beginning. And Benjamin Netanyahu, in his oration, makes that point, you know, explicitly. One of the strongest non-Jewish supporters of the State of Israel that there have ever been.
No, indeed. Amin and Bill, I wonder whether you can tell us about the role of the Ulster Volunteer Force in the early part of the 20th century and how it relates to the modern-day UVF from 1966 onwards.
Well, the Ulster Volunteer Force, as you've said earlier, was formed as an illegal militia, a very major militia, to oppose the possibility of home rule, to oppose it in arms, just as other unionists were opposing it politically. When the Home Rule Bill was brought in, First World War started, the UVF in effect entered the British Army en masse and fought at the Western Front in particular. The organisation was disbanded in the early 1920s. A new organisation was formed in 1966, and it was given the same name as a sort of homage to the original organisation, but there is no sort of direct continuity between the two. The UVF saw themselves, as opposed to the UDA, as being the more thoughtful, the more politicized organization. At various times have called themselves, for example, socialists. they have also been, however, as militaristic as the UDA, and as the mural that you're showing there indicates, even currently that mural still exists. In fact, that mural is painted after the ceasefire of 1994, and it shows armed men saying that they're ready for peace, prepared for war, but all the iconography, all the symbolism in the mural is certainly about militarism and not about peacemaking.
David, I mean, what about this connection to the Netanyahu family? And I mean, I watched the Benjamin Netanyahu's eulogy to Patterson when his ashes were taken to Israel. And so it's all true. I mean, as I understand it, Netanyahu even named his firstborn son after him. But isn't this the kind of detail that would normally be denounced as a sort of a conspiracy theory?
It would be, but we have as a source Benjamin Netanyahu himself, and talking about his elder brother, Jonathan, who was named in part after John Henry Patterson. Patterson was actually his godfather, and Netanyahu makes a point in the speech Patterson gave him a cup, gave the family a cup to celebrate his christening, to celebrate the godfather relationship. Yeah. And that's because he'd met Netanyahu's father, Benzion Netanyahu, who was a lieutenant to Jabotinsky in the US in the early period before the creation of the State of Israel. So the extraordinary coincidence there, isn't there? I mean, that connection. So when Netanyahu refers to him as the godfather of the so-called IDF, yeah, he's also, of course, godfather to his own brother. I mean, extraordinary connections there, showing the connections between Protestant settlers and the Jewish settlers in Palestine.
Yes, indeed. Truly is extraordinary. But we're just going to pause there for a moment now to report on the affinities between Ulster loyalism and Zionism on the one hand, and between Irish Republicans and the Palestinian cause on the other.
The mural of John Henry Patterson, which celebrates settler colonialism and ethnic cleansing, is situated on the Loyalist side of the so-called Peace Line in West Belfast. It is a structure not too dissimilar to the Zionist Separation Wall. The mural has been attacked more than once, leading to allegations of bigotry and hate crime. But it's equally clear that it's not just anti-Protestant to criticize the racist ideology of loyalism, just as it's not anti-Jewish to criticize Zionism. But this mural is not an isolated expression of support for Zionism within loyalism. In occupied Al-Quds, the Zionists celebrate Flag Day or Jerusalem Day, in which they rampage around the old city, chanting death to the Arabs and similar slogans. This is extraordinarily similar to the annual 12th of July parades in the north of Ireland, which celebrate Protestant domination over the Irish. In loyalist areas, the flag of Israel proudly flies beside the Union Jack, the Red Hand of Ulster, and the flags of loyalist death squads. And on the 12th of July, their intimidatory parades and huge bonfires are set ablaze with symbols of Irish republicanism, effigies of prominent Catholics, banners reading Kill All Irish or All Tags, a racist term for Catholics, are targets, and yes, Palestinian flags too. All over the north, there are murals celebrating Palestinian resistance. In Derry's Bogside, where British paratroopers murdered 14 civilians on Bloody Sunday in 1972, Palestinian flags fly all year round. BDS is supported and Palestinian resistance celebrated. It was in Derry, let's remember, where the Raytheon factory was occupied by Palestine solidarity activists, forcing the company to close the factory and stop the supply of weapons to Israel. What is it about the north of Ireland that the occupation of Palestine is so keenly debated there? We're told that it's just a matter of old sectarian hatreds, of tribalism, which should have been left behind decades ago. Some, like the British priest Giles Fraser, scorn the idea that Ireland and Palestine are similar. He writes, "By seeing one set of troubles through the lens of another, we create an intractable confusion that does nothing to further the cause of peace." But the reality is that the affinity of Irish Republicans for the Palestinians and of loyalists for Zionism flows directly from the parallel settler colonial dynamic of both conflicts. When the people of Derry say free Palestine, they do it from an instinctive feel for the oppression of the Palestinians, born from their own experience of British-backed settler colonialism in Ireland.
Bill, I mean, I think many people recognise that there is an obvious link between republicanism and the Palestinian cause. But I wonder whether you could say a little bit about the fact that, you know, Israeli flags fly in loyalist areas of Belfast. Because, you know, a lot of people, you know, looking in from the outside would find that rather strange. I wonder if you could maybe say a bit more about, unpack that for us.
Yeah, well, there's possibly two reasons. One is the, you know, a version of that old notion that, you know, my enemy's, what is it? My enemy's friend is my enemy. There's a notion that my enemy's enemy is my friend. And what I mean by that is that if the Palestinians are flying, or if the Republicans are flying Palestinian flags, one way to annoy Republicans is to fly an Israeli flag. And sometimes I have a feeling that it's nothing more deep than that, just a sort of a provocative sort of thing. However, there is sometimes something much more deep going on. But I sort of beg to differ with part of your argument here, in the sense that it's too easy to make an exact parallel between here and the Middle East. But there were people who made direct parallels. Let's go back to 1917, 1920. Sir Richard Storrs, who was governor of Jerusalem at the time, said that he was looking for a Jewish homeland because it would provide, I quote, a little loyal Jewish Ulster in a sea of potentially hostile Arabism. Now, to me, that gives a lot away. The argument is that Ulster is surrounded by enemies, just as Israel is surrounded by enemies. That is the ideology. That is the notion that's put across. And so it's a remarkable sort of thing where the dominant force in the north of Ireland, unionism, sees itself as somehow the victimized ones, sees itself as somehow under attack. But this is where that old biblical notion of Israel constantly under attack, the Zionist notion in Israel today of Israel being constantly under attack, plays out in this sort of notion of victimhood. It's a strange sort of thing, but I think that's what's going on. It's not as nakedly supremacist as it might first appear. It's more about victimology.
David, do you see a kind of parallel between the false anti-Semitism allegations that we've seen in the UK in the recent past and an attempt to present Ulster loyalism as a kind of victim of bigotry?
Yes, absolutely. And I think Bill's just kind of, you know, explained that really, really very well. I mean, yes, the loyalists see themselves as being victims. And indeed, the Zionists do as well, in a way. I mean, in a way, they see themselves as being, you know, the muscular, strong Jews who were able to reestablish, as they would see it, the Jewish state. On the other hand, they see themselves as being constantly under assault from what they call the oldest hatred, from anti-Semitism. And there's a very strong parallel in those ideas that somehow Jews are always going to be victims, Protestants are always going to be victims, they're left behind by the British Empire for the Protestants. And for the Jews, you know, it's that they face a hostile world. And the reason they have to have Israel is because the whole world is always unredeemingly hostile towards the Jews. Now, of course, this is a fantasy, and it's a fantasy which they deliberately encourage and work upon. And it's a fantasy, too, in the case of the loyalists in Northern Ireland. They are the dominant ones. They may have been, as they would see it, betrayed by the British, in the sense the British don't support them as much as they should do, in their view. But they nevertheless are the ones who are in charge. They're the ones who have the jobs. Systematically, the bias against Catholics in the job market, etc., even after all these years after the civil rights movement. So, yeah, there is a strong parallel, and it's really instructive to pay attention to it, because it makes it clear just how ideological work is going on in both cases.
Yes, indeed. I mean, of course, the whole notion of the so-called, you know, province was kind of gerrymandered, yeah, to because, I mean, part of, you know, Ireland, as it were, is actually to the north of so-called Northern Ireland.
That's right.
It's a curious state of affairs. But Bill, I wonder whether you can tell us a bit about where this mural's located and the significance of the peace lines.
Yeah, the mural is located just on the Protestant side of the peace line in West Belfast. It's just up beyond the gates that are closed to this day, closed every night and opened every morning to prevent direct passage between the two areas. It's a bit of a mystery, because in a car, it would only take you about 3 minutes to drive alternative way between the two areas. However, this is what exists. Now, The point is that these peace lines were put there by the state, right? And in that sense, your parallel to the wall in Israel is correct. However, it's a little bit different from the wall in Israel in that if you talk to people, as has been done in some surveys, on both sides of the peace line, the closer you get to the peace line, the more that people unanimously agree that the wall should stay there forever. So the further away you are, you can see, oh, this is a blot on the landscape, we should get rid of it. But close up, people on both sides see this wall as defensive. And that is a major distinction between Belfast and say, Bethlehem.
Yeah. I mean, David, what about these bonfires? We saw some of those in the film there. I mean, they include effigies of well-known individuals hanged by the neck. I mean, it reminds me of the images of lynchings in the deep south of the US. Is that a fair description, do you think?
Seems fair to me. I mean, of course, there's a parallel too there, isn't it? Because the US is a successful settler colony in the sense they managed to eliminate almost all of the natives. And so, yes, there is a parallel there. And the ideas that there were in the Deep South about racial superiority very much parallel both in Palestine amongst the Zionists and amongst the Ulster Loyalists. But I think I'm from Scotland. I grew up seeing this kind of stuff in Scotland because it exists there too. Not like to anything like the same extent. The bonfire is not nearly so big, but there are parades, you know. And you see that on there, you see the, I mean, there are portraits of Sinn Féin and Republican politicians, some of them hang by the neck. There are even portraits of socialist politicians. There are the flag of the EU is up there sometimes as well. Yeah. Palestinian flag, very, very prominent. And lots of racist epithets. The use of the word Taig, for example, a derogatory term for Catholic. The phrase kill all Irish, which really, for me, has such resonance of death to the Arabs, which we get in Jerusalem. Cool, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think these are extraordinary things. People don't know in this part of what's laughingly called the UK, that this kind of thing still happens. These are hate fests, which are allowed by the state. It's incredible.
Briefly, and finally, Bill, I understand that you've been involved in the Palestine solidarity activities in Belfast for some time now. I wonder if you could just sort of say, what's the pro-Palestinian movement like in Ireland? If you could be brief, because we're running very short of time.
Oh, that's slightly untrue. I've been a supporter of the Palestinian cause in Ireland for as long as I can remember, but I've never been directly involved in organizing. So I couldn't speak to that one, honestly, Chris. But can I briefly say something else? We haven't mentioned the British Israel notion, the notion that the British are derived from the lost tribes of Israel, right? Now, that was a big thing in the 19th century, a really huge thing. It's more or less defunct now. But however, at least three unionist politicians here within living memory have been prime proponents of that notion. Robert Bradford, who was the MP for South Belfast, where I'm sitting at the moment. Another Clifford Smith was another unionist politician who was a British Israelite. And currently Nelson McCausland, former minister here and a member of the DUP, is a prominent British Israelite. So that's another strand in that connection to Israel that's going on in loyalist ideology.
We may well return to that, but unfortunately, we are out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there for today. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, Bill, and obviously David. Thank you. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme.
In the Limelight. Atrocities and wrongs suffered by indigenous peoples around the world have been put under the spotlight as a result of the death of Britain's Queen Elizabeth II. We have taken a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency has covered this story. When newly elected Indigenous Australian parliamentarian Lydia Thorpe took her oath of office last month, she raised her fist above her head in protest and labelled Queen Elizabeth II a colonising queen. It was like kneeling to the murderer, the Green senator told the Reuters news agency this week. I had to swear my allegiance to a colonising power that had caused so much harm to our people. The death of Queen Elizabeth II has led First Nation peoples from Canada to Australia and former colonies in the Caribbean islands to speak about their pain and their marginalisation, as well as renewing calls for the removal of the monarchy as head of state in some countries. The accession of King Charles III comes amid a rise in anti-colonialism fueled by a growing awareness of historical atrocities and a greater recognition of Indigenous culture and knowledge. There's rising popular consciousness around injustices around the world, what's carried out in the name of one's own nation for the exploitation of Indigenous peoples, said Veldon Coburn, an Indigenous Anishinaabe professor at the University of Ottawa in Canada. He added, almost overlapping with Queen Elizabeth's reign from the 1950s, you also see resistance movements emerging. Calls are growing in some Caribbean countries for reparation payments and an apology for slavery, while Canadian Indigenous leaders want the British monarchy to act on a swathe of historical injustices. Australia is on a path to give Aboriginal people a formal voice on Indigenous matters in Parliament. But Thorpe contrasted the government's decision to hold a day of mourning for the Queen with the historical neglect of Indigenous Australians. It is just another nail in the coffin in terms of how we feel and how we are treated as First Nations people, she said. It's like we never existed. The changing demographic in Commonwealth nations and accusations of racism in the royal family following the exit of Prince Harry and Meghan has led to more questions about the need for a distant monarch as head of state. A decision by Barbados to ditch the Queen Elizabeth II as head of state in November of 2021 was seen as a boost for the Republican cause and has been echoed in other Caribbean nations such as Jamaica and Bahamas. Opinion polls in Australia, New Zealand, Canada have all pointed to a growing view that they should end ties to the British monarchy with the death of Queen Elizabeth II. Even though this is unlikely anytime soon in countries like Canada. In New Zealand, Indigenous Maori people account for about 17% of the country's 5 million population. They are well represented in Parliament. Maori has been made an official language of New Zealand, and the history of British colonisation is taught in public schools. Maoris are also overrepresented in prisons and state care in New Zealand, and the community remains the country's poorest section of the population. If we can't address the negativity and impact of colonisation now, then when? Do we wait for Prince William or Prince William's children? Asked Maori Party co-leader Debbie Ngarewa-Packer, who supports abolishing the monarchy and a New Zealand head of state. No one taking that role, king or queen, princess or prince, is unaware of the damage of colonization to us as indigenous peoples, she said. New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has said she expects New Zealand to become a republic eventually, but not anytime soon. Australia's Labour Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, who openly favours a republic, has asked a minister with making this happen. But any change would require a referendum in Australia and is only expected if the government wins a second term in office. In Canada, polls suggest about half of all people believe the country should end ties to the British monarchy with the death of Queen Elizabeth II. Indigenous peoples of Canada account for less than 5% of Canada's population of about 38 million people, and they suffer from higher levels of poverty, unemployment, and a lower life expectancy than other sections of the Canadian population. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has taken a look at opposition to Britain's monarchy within the population of Britain itself. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has covered the story from this angle. The controversy over the right to protest in the United Kingdom has come under the spotlight since the death of Queen Elizabeth II, as British police's handling of anti-monarchy protests has been criticised. The controversy came amid the shockwave caused by the death of Queen Elizabeth II last week after her 70-year-long reign. British police arrested a woman in Edinburgh for holding an anti-monarchy sign reading, "Not My King," targeting the new monarch, King Charles III, according to local media reports. A protester who shouted and called Prince Andrew, who was the centre of attention after being forced by Buckingham Palace to resign from all of his public roles over a scandal involving Jeffrey Epstein, a sick old man, was the first to face arrest. The incident took place during the procession that took Queen Elizabeth II's coffin from the Palace of Holyrood House to St Giles Cathedral, and a 22-year-old man who was arrested after being manhandled and shoved by some public members, and a video of it has been largely circulated over social media. In a separate incident, a barrister was warned in London by police that a placard saying, "Not my king," would see him arrested. The barrister was holding an empty placard. The reaction to the arrest has mounted on social media almost immediately after they took place, with many human rights activists joining. The campaign group Republic has written to police forces in Britain to raise concerns about the latest arrests and notice that it expects protests ahead of the coronation to be allowed to go ahead peacefully. Civil liberties groups and MPs have also expressed alarm.
Insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the war in Ukraine with TV correspondent Johnny Miller. But first, this brief analysis.
It is said that the first victim of war is the truth. And this seems to be especially the case as it relates to the war in Ukraine. Very rarely have the global consumers of Western media been subjected to such a high level of propaganda, ridiculously pro-Ukrainian and viciously anti-Russian, in line with NATO objectives. Western news outlets have taken upon themselves to basically be the public relations arm of NATO. The level of public shaming and gaslighting of experts, academics, and journalists in the media is so intense that there are virtually no Western politicians courageous enough to publicly disagree with the warmongering and hype. Not to mention the fact that right at the beginning of the war, all Russian media were banned in the West by the Western champions of liberal democracy and free speech, lest the so-called wrong facts get transmitted to Western citizens and mess up NATO's plans for a long, attritional war with Russia. In this environment, Press TV has tried to conduct fair reporting by reporting the facts from both sides, some of which expose the lies and false narratives being propagated by Western media in their zeal to be of service to Western military and security organizations. Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller reported the facts as he saw it, including crimes committed by the neo-Nazi elements of the Ukrainian military, as well as reports that paint a somewhat different picture of the mood and morale among Ukrainian civilians than the rosy caricature often portrayed in Western media. Johnny Miller's reward for his excellent journalistic effort is that he was placed on a so-called kill list of Ukrainian neo-Nazis, which includes personal information and encourages people to murder the people on the list, an Italian journalist already falling victim to this outrage. The evil combination of neo-Nazi fanatics being sponsored by the suit and tie-wearing terrorists of NATO make it very difficult to discuss and possibly find a peaceful solution to this devastating war. The comedian president of Ukraine seems to have realized that there will not be a military victory in the cards for Ukraine against Russia. But he might also be in too deep with his neo-Nazi NATO cabal to be able to do anything other than what he's ordered to do. Otherwise, he too might one day end up on the Ukrainian neo-Nazi kill list.
Johnny Miller, thank you for joining us on Insight. I want to spend our time today talking about the war in Ukraine. As you know, our program, we try to look at the historic, the strategic context of the news that we witness on a daily basis, something that unfortunately is no longer there in Western media, in mainstream media. But before we get to that, you know, the rule in journalism is that the journalist should never himself or herself become the story. But unfortunately, it seems that some people don't play by those rules. And it seems, unfortunately, that they put your name on this so-called kill list. It's even nasty to even say it, but unfortunately, that seems to be what has happened. We shouldn't act like nations don't have their own national interests. We shouldn't act like because there was European integration, because there is this kind of solidarity within the Western countries, that somehow, you know, whatever is in America's interest is also in Germany's interest, or whatever is in America's interest is also in Sweden or Britain's interest. Of course, you said, you know, I'm going to out myself as a Scottish nationalist, so I would say the Scots don't have to worry about the oil. They have enough oil and gas for themselves. But a place like Germany, obviously, is a major problem if they can't have normal relations with Russia, because their entire industry, it's not only oil and gas, it's aluminum, it's various raw materials that are the basis of this mighty German, you know, industrial system that exists there. So yeah, I think maybe the story, and this is good when we have these kind of conversations, we get to some new insight, which is the point of our program, is that maybe, like you said, this is going to have a much more devastating effect on these Western European countries who are. And again, I think we should distinguish between the people and the elites. I think most people in Europe are keenly aware of that this is just wrong. Yes, they might not, they don't agree with Russian invasion. They sympathize with the Ukrainian people. It's not that they are on the Russian side, but they realize that it is not in their interest to become this kind of, you know, cannon fodder for NATO or America's, you know, imperial plans or strategic plans.
I don't know about that. I mean, I'll tell you when I go back to London. I haven't been there for a while. But before I went, I mean, there seems to be the propaganda. Noam Chomsky and John Pilger said a couple of weeks ago that since the Vietnam War, all these years they've been imposing, they've never seen the propaganda like in this war, in any else. And I think it's largely working. I mean, I'll get back to you when I go back to London, but there seems to be, as I said, no serious debate about NATO's involvement of this whitewashing of the extremists. And I expect this propaganda is having a huge effect. I mean, now Ukraine is largely off the news, I think. It was big for the first month. Now it's largely off it. So I do wonder, actually, just how many people know much about Ukraine. But I think what you will see, of course, is the further gas prices go up and food prices go up, and the further that's linked to Ukraine, which is a big part of why they're going up, then, of course, I think people, for their own self-interest, might start to wonder, why are we in Ukraine? And then you may well see more reporting about the kind of stuff that I'm reporting on. But if you see policy-making change, you may well see some of the journalists being sent to East Ukraine and Donbass and starting to tell the whole story. Well, you know, maybe there are some pro-Russian people there, or maybe there are some extremists. Maybe we shouldn't be sending weapons. Maybe we should push for peace. So you might see the media narrative change if you see the policy, government policy change.
Well, you know, I think this is an interesting thing we can speculate about, which is that there's a desperate attempt, it seems to me, by NATO, which is basically an American military organization. I mean, it's true, it has all these different countries that are in it, but everybody knows that it's, you know, basically America's military coalition, that it can command to do whatever it wants. It seems to me that the defeat in Afghanistan was really something that was an existential problem for these people. They had come in and said that, you know, NATO is going to be, Afghanistan is going to be the great project that proves that NATO is still relevant after the Cold War, after the demise of the Soviet Union. And after 20 years, you know, it was just shambles. It was just a mess, as we all remember the way that they fled from Kabul. And it seems to me, and, you know, I think I have reason to be cynical and not have a good view of Western elites and not be optimistic about that they want good for themselves and for their own people, based on what we've seen from them. I think there was an idea that, hey, you know what, we're going to revive NATO here, we're going to give it a new sort of life, we're going to try to, you know, make it relevant and keep it relevant, maybe bring in some new people. You know, you got Sweden and Russia, Sweden and Finland talking about doing these things, which is very strange. Sweden and Finland were historically always neutral. Even during the Cold War, they were not part of NATO, which was probably more threatening than we have today. You know, Russia, it's very unlikely Russia is going to attack Finland or Sweden. I mean, it's almost, you know, you know, it's virtually impossible that they would do that. So I think we can't underestimate the level to which they're going to desperately try to keep this going, even if the people in the West don't want it to go on. We saw it with the Iraq War.
I think you're right with the difference between the elites and the people. We're seeing that many examples of it. Increasingly, elites just don't seem to care about the people's living standards. But they may well care more about this grand policy. There's one of the propaganda debates about in this war has been what have Russia's aims been. The West likes to say that Russia tried to take Kiev, failed. So it's this great big victory from Ukraine. I was in Kiev at the start of the war.
Please tell us about it.
So the Russian troops were surrounded Kiev, not entirely surrounded. They allowed people to get in and out through a train route. But there was hardly any strikes, maybe four or five strikes. If you're going to try to take Kiev, it's clear that Russia's aims are to take over the pro-Russian areas of Ukraine. I think Russia may well have learned their lesson from the Afghanistan in the 90s, or indeed the Americans in Afghanistan. The Americans were in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now who's back in power? The Taliban. It's very hard for a country to rule or take over a country when you have a hostile population. Russia is trying to take over the Donbass region, the southern region. Crimea, of course, annexed 8 years ago. And right. the vast majority of people in Crimea are Russian, so they haven't had no internal problems.
Yeah, I mean, Khrushchev, who was Ukrainian, gave it to the Ukraine during his rule in the Soviet Union.
Sure. Donbass is the vast majority Russian, so where I was in Donbass, Russia doesn't have any problems controlling those territories. In the southern region, just above Crimea, that's yes. more complicated. Right. Russia's taken that area in order to safeguard Crimea. Crimea, of course, crucial for their geopolitics. They can control Absolutely. The Black Sea from there, which is very important to them. I was in that area. There it's a lot more mixed. I went to the streets. I interviewed a dozen groups of people. About 25% of those people, I'd say, were openly pro-Russian. 25% were openly pro-Ukrainian, although some of them asking to see my British press credentials before answering because they're worried about the authorities. Right. But interestingly, about 50% of the people said they've got Russian family, Ukrainian family, and they just want peace.
Right.
Now, since the Russians took over that area, you may well have seen more Ukrainians leave, mm-hmm. And so it's become more of a pro-Russian area. But there's also terrorist attacks or insurgent attacks by Ukrainians, so it's much more mixed. If Russia was to take over the rest of Kiev or the Western Kiev, it would be very hard for them to control that in
Absolutely.
The long term. Just that Absolutely. the Americans found out in Afghanistan. Very hard for them to do that with a hostile population. And so it's not Russia's desire to do that, but my fear is that the Americans may well want that to happen. They want to drag Russia into a long war here. So if you keep arming Ukraine, Russia's, and it's openly said it, it's going to have to go further. And so that's why you might see this war drag on for years, mm-hmm. rather than anybody suing for peace. For a long-term NATO strategy to try and drag Russia into a new Afghanistan, if you will. Russia's invasion of Afghanistan in the 80s is largely attributed to bring down the Soviet Union. And I think that's what NATO's plan is here as well, to bring Russia in to a new Afghanistan. And that's why Russia wants to keep to the pro-Russian areas, but they may well be forced to go further by NATO.
So you don't see any signs within Ukraine, I'm talking about the Ukrainian side, not the Russian speakers or the ethnic Russians, on the Ukrainian side of them wanting to somehow get to a peace agreement or some sort of end of hostilities?
So the Russian side or the Ukrainian side?
No, the Ukrainian side.
On the Ukrainian side, I think the people, once again, you asked the people. I'd be fascinated if you did a referendum in Ukraine today, either including the pro-Russian areas or not including the pro-Russian areas. If you did a referendum in Ukraine before the Russian invasion started, you asked the Ukrainian people, would you be happy to give away Crimea and Donbass, or there's going to be a Russian invasion? I think we'd be very interested in the answer to that. I think most people in Ukraine, I'm just speculating, but mm-hmm. I do have some contacts there. For Crimea and Donbass, pro-Russian areas, you know, most Ukrainians, as long as they're not ultra-nationalists, would say, let's just let them have that. But then you've got this area above Crimea, which is more complicated. Many Ukrainians saying, well, we give them Crimea and Donbass, but what about this area, Kherson, for example,
right.
which may well have been majority Ukrainian before Russia got involved. So that's when it becomes a lot more complicated. But if you ask the Ukrainian people now, do you want to negotiate for peace, even if it means ceding territory? I think the majority, I think, would say yes. But that's why you have the government and the nationalists who are very much pushing for war. I mean, as a journalist here in Ukraine, I spend a lot of time on the Telegram channels, okay? That's the new sort of way of journalism. You have to spend a lot of time on the Telegram channels of soldiers and civilians posting videos from the front lines or posting videos of what's going on the streets of West Ukraine. I can't tell you how many videos I saw of conscription officers of the Ukrainian military going into beaches, going on the streets, literally chasing Ukrainian citizens to hand them out conscription notices. You have the old men of military age, 18 to 60, are not allowed to leave the country. They're effectively prisoners in the country and increasingly being forced to fight. And when they do join up, they've hardly got any military experience, being sent to the front line with almost no weapons. Once again, I can't tell you how many videos I've seen of Ukrainian soldiers with their whole company behind them, reading out a statement to President Zelensky saying, you sent us here with no weapons, we don't want to fight, we refuse to fight, we're going home, essentially. I can't tell you how many videos I've seen of that. You don't see any of that in Western media, by the way.
Yeah, very interesting. None of that is in Western media. It's all this kind of propaganda, you know.
It's incredible. I did one story about it, I think. But I can't say how many videos I've seen. And these are Ukrainians posting it. So it's not propaganda. These are Ukrainian soldiers posting these videos to President Zelensky. And I've seen countless numbers of them. And the Western media just says Ukrainian morale is sky high. It's not sky high. It may be sky high amongst some of the nationalists or the people at the back. But against and it's poor people who are sent to these front lines mainly. Forced to fight, sent to the front lines, and hundreds at one stage, I'm not sure about the numbers now, one stage hundreds were dying every day under Russian artillery. It's an absolute slaughter. This is mainly a proxy war now. So Ukrainian people are being used as cannon fodder for an American proxy war in Ukraine. And it's shocking. And so many people still in the West say, stand for Ukraine. Both standing for Ukraine, continue to send them weapons, is literally sending them in to die. And I can't believe how there's not more people pushing for a peaceful negotiated settlement. And one of the reasons there's not is because of the level of propaganda. And also the propaganda making Russia out to be evil people, not just evil government, but evil people. Absolutely. They must be stopped. They're going to invade Eastern Europe. Russia's not going to invade Eastern Europe unless it's pushed to. It's trying to take over Crimea because that's what's important to them and throw Russian areas. But the level of propaganda in order to keep sending money to Ukraine so more Ukrainians die, it's shocking.
Okay, Johnny, so let's talk about the future a little bit because, I mean, it's pretty bleak what's going on right now, both in terms of what's happening in the Ukraine and the areas where there's conflict, but also, as we were talking, also what's happening to the public in Western Europe and the political and the social environment that we have, this kind of, you know, suffocating, you know, propaganda. So let's try to look to the future a little bit. So let's start with what you were just talking about, which is the idea that maybe it's not sustainable for the Ukrainians to continue much longer. And, you know, everything I've seen from the Russian side points to the fact that they are willing to compromise if they can get, you know, in terms of having the independence of those Donbass republics and Crimea. So if you could give us a little insight on that.
I think, first of all, I don't think Russia's interested in negotiations at the moment either, because essentially if NATO continues to send them weapons, increasingly very high-tech, high-powered weapons that can hit Donetsk or hit Crimea, then Russia doesn't really see a point in negotiating. It's said clearly that if NATO keeps sending these weapons and threatening our cities, we're just going to have to take more of Ukraine. You've got the major cities of Kharkiv and Odessa. I've asked frequently Russian journalists or politicians, do they want to take these cities? Kharkiv and Odessa do have large Russian minorities in them. So if they were to take these cities, with the amount of Ukrainians that flee, they could well be able to control them in the long term. It wouldn't be like Kiev, where the overwhelming population is hostile. So they might want to take these cities as well. But if NATO continues to send weapons to Ukraine, I think Russia will just continue to fight. And maybe that's NATO's aim. Do NATO politicians really care about the death of Ukrainian people or the destruction of Ukrainian cities? If there were hundreds of British or American soldiers dying every single day in Ukraine, you'd have absolute outcry about it. But there's no outcry in Britain because they're Ukrainians. It doesn't really matter to them.
Well, do you think the Ukrainian government can sustain it? I mean, obviously, we know that NATO doesn't care about the Ukrainians, but does it reach a point where the Zelensky government is no longer able to continue this?
Well, you've just had in the last few days a purge by Zelensky of very important figures. I think the head of the SBU, a former friend of his, has been kicked out. Some other high-ranking figures. So we're not quite sure why this is. The Americans have also just warned about Zelensky's security. Some analysts have said the Americans essentially threatened him.
Right.
And this is increasingly, you expect to see much more repression in Ukraine. And this is all part of, we started this conversation talking about a kill list. Well, in Ukrainian society, it's basically impossible to criticize the government or to criticize the nationalists because it's so dangerous there. So you're going to see so much more repression in Ukraine, forcing people to do what the government says. I also can't tell you how many videos I've seen online of women in Ukraine standing up to these conscription officers or posting their own videos saying, you're taking our men to the front line.
Correct.
And I'm seeing increasingly angry video posts particularly from women in Ukraine as well, and men, just say this, we can't keep sustaining this. So you ask a good question of whether Ukraine can keep sustaining it. I think the NATO has so much control over Ukraine. I mean, NATO could change the Ukrainian government whenever it wanted. They fund and arm the Ukrainians. They basically control.
So do you think it would be correct to say that is it related to the person of Zelensky, or is it not that important whether he remains or he goes?
I don't think it's that important. I mean, Zelensky isn't an ultra nationalist. I mean, I actually think he's quite a decent guy, to be honest with you. Before he became president, he said a famous interview in which he said, just let the pro-Russians speak Russian. Just let them do it. Why do we have to force them not to? He did a lot of work in stopping corruption or helping to stop corruption before the Russian invasion. So I think Zelensky's quite a decent guy, a reasonably moderate guy. But he doesn't really have much power here. You've got the Americans on one side and the ultra-nationalists on the other, and he's caught in the middle, having to do whatever he's told, frankly. So you may well see more purges or maybe a change of government, but NATO is clearly determined to keep this war going on as long as possible. But as you say, there may well be a breaking point at some point in which the Ukrainians simply can't sustain it. But whether this war is going to last another few months or... I mean, Afghanistan lasted 20 years, so that's my fear.
Well, you know, I think you're right. I mean, I don't think it's going to be 20 years. It might be maybe a year or two. But the way I see it, that, you know, Russia is not crumbling. All the sanctions haven't worked. They've actually backfired on the West. Russia is doing okay. You know, it's not under pressure. You saw we recently had President Putin and President Erdogan come to Tehran for the big summit about Syria. So it doesn't seem to be that the Western policy, the Western strategy has been working against Russia. Tell us what the mood is. You're across the border. What is the mood in Russia on all this issue?
Yeah, before going to Donbass, the Russians, of course, call this a special military operation. Well, for people in Russia, this does very much feel like a special military operation on the edges of the empire, if you like. It's not really affecting Russian people all that much. Yes, the sanctions are damaging. Certainly some people who work in trade with the West, for example.
All right, so listen, Johnny, I want to conclude with going back to the West a little bit. And, you know, I want to also commend you and say thank you. You deserve some rest. You were in very difficult situations. You are now going to spend a little time resting. But before we end our conversation, let's go back to the West. We talked about the future in Ukraine. You talked about how in Russia it's not really affecting daily life. And we also talked about, you know, the idea that maybe the Europeans miscalculated. Do you feel that there is a chance, an opportunity, that there would be a movement in Western countries? Of course, each country is different. We don't want to generalize. Where you could see people, you know, starting to protest about this and trying to get this to end, because it seems it's going to have a bad effect on them, especially when it gets colder. And when, you know, they start feeling the problems in terms of prices and the effects it has on their daily life.
Well, the Russian media likes to make out that all these Western leaders are falling now with Boris Johnson, the Italian, and they like to think that it's all because of Ukraine. I think maybe some of it is. I do point out to a Russian journalist that Boris Johnson is scandal after domestic scandal, and that's the major reason he's fallen. But I think particularly when you see winter coming, and gas prices going up so much, I think you may well see a lot of people start saying, is this war really worth it? And increasingly politicians, particularly German, French, Emmanuel Macron is still on the phone to Putin all the time. Russia and Germany do have relations with Russia. So I think winter, you may well see an opportunity for European countries to say, look, we're not having any more of this. And without Russian and without French and German support, can the Americans and Brits go it alone in Ukraine and arming Ukraine? I'm not sure. But I think maybe when winter comes, you may well see another opportunity, if you like, for particularly European countries to question whether their continued support of Ukraine militarily rather than pushing for peace is really the right option for the European people.
Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller, thank you so much for joining us. I know you were tired, but you took the time to have a conversation with us. Thank you very much. Get some rest. Stay safe, and looking forward to more of your excellent reporting.
Thank you so much. And we're also going to open the window. It's got so hot in here.